9 a.m. Everybody awake and ready for some fun? Yeah? All right. So today I'm going to go through a little bit about how Netflix debugs and fixes Apache Cassandra. I'm Joey Lynch. I work on the cloud data engineering team at Netflix. I'm a distributed systems addict, and I like to say data wrangler because, I mean, let's be honest, it gets out of control sometimes. And today I want to go over how we debug. And to do that, I want to start with, like, what do we actually think debugging is? So I think that this is kind of a pretty succinct way to put it. Debugging is the practice of observing a system, building a mental model of that system, and then rapidly testing your newly formed mental model. Although it's typically while that system's on fire. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun, I think. And if you learn through graphs instead, here's a good kind of diagram, I think, of how to attack a distributed system debugging issue. So you're kind of observing the actual state of the world, then you're using that to update your mental model. That then allows you to create theories about what's going on, and then you propose experiments that you'll then run on the world to try to figure out what's going on. And throughout this whole talk, we'll kind of be going in steps, talking through progressively more difficult things to debug, and we'll be using this technique the whole way. All right, so we'll start off with one of my favorite ways that Cassandra fails, which is what I like to call distributed woes. Distributed systems fail in especially fun ways compared to non-distributed ones. One of them is this. Who's ever had a user report that looks something like this? Nobody? Okay, a couple people. We see a large number of timeouts. And you're like, okay, cool. We got some timeouts. Let's go check out what's going on. Just from the bug report, we have some initial theories that we can start forming, just based on our mental model of like how Cassandra works as a database. So our first theory, which we always need to consider, is that there's no actual problem, right? There might not actually be a problem. Maybe it's like one error. It might not actually be an issue. But if it is an issue, we can, like, just from timeouts, we're like, okay, well, maybe a replica is slow. Maybe we're like having some bad interactions with our clients. And so at this point, we don't really have enough to rule out anything or to really make concrete proposals. So we're going to go and do what every good debugger does, which is start observing the world. We're going to observe metrics. We're going to read some logs, look for clues, and then kind of go from there and start making new theories. So we pull up our Cassandra dashboard. Everybody has a good operational dashboard of Cassandra, right? Because Cassandra has all these great metrics. Yeah. So this is really important because it allows you to start off with just immediately ruling out large classes of things. So I start looking at this, and I'm immediately seeing a couple of interesting patterns. So, for example, the service traffic is staying somewhat constant, but what about the Cassandra traffic? Is the Cassandra traffic following the service traffic? What about the latencies? The latencies seem pretty similar. So just from this data, we can already start in our head forming a mental model of like what might be happening. So just a quick poll of the room. Of those earlier theories that we were looking at, what do people think is maybe likely just from this data? Go for it. Retry storm. All right. You and I, we're thinking similarly right now. But just to rule out a couple of the other ones, we're going to check some more graphs. We're going to look at latencies broken down by node, just because we want to rule out any possibility of it being a slow replica. That's a very quick thing for us to rule out here. We can just like look at this graph and say, yeah, all the replicas got slow at the same time. We don't see any drops or errors from the from Cassandra, which is where Cassandra reports that it has been unable to process a read or write. So this is really, I think, starting to build a story around retries. But let's just really make sure. Let's rule out, for example, the first problem. So we go over to the clients, and we start looking at their logs, and we're like, okay, well, are there exceptions? 1,213, that's like, you know, not too good. You know, it's not bad, it's not a million, but it's still not good. What kind of exception is it? And then we're kind of asking these questions, right? We're trying to update our mental model of what's going on. Oh, it's an operation timed out exception, which the driver folks in the room are immediately going to the conclusion here. But for those of you not familiar, then you get some more context, right? So I always, whenever I like get an initial error line, I'm always like, well, what is this actual error? And especially with Java, because it has like 20 line stack traces, you got to get some context around that. And I think that this is really the line that starts really helping you form the mental model. We've timed out waiting for a server response from the client. And then finally, we're just double checking, like, okay, are those most of the errors, or is that just what my grep happened to pull up? And sure enough, that's most of the issues. So we're seeing these operation timed out exceptions. Then we go and look at the server just to double check, quickly skim, nothing looks interesting. Cassandra's running some compaction. It's always running some compaction. It's really fine. So now we can revisit those theories that we started with, and we can immediately rule out a couple. So we can rule out that there was no actual problem because we saw errors, we saw latency, we saw exceptions. We can also rule out degraded replicas because we had consistent latency across our replica set. So this is kind of leaving us with our last couple of hypotheses, retry storm and load shift. All right, so what do we know? We know there's a problem. We know there's a spike in Cassandra traffic when there's no spike in service traffic. We know that we're seeing client-side timeouts and no server timeouts. So the retry storm does appear most likely according to our mental model of how Cassandra works. And in order to prove it, we need to run some experiments. We need to ask some questions, like what are some experiments that would show us that it is a retry storm? Well, one thing is we can go and observe the timeout that the client's using. And one thing that's really convenient at Netflix is that we often have our timeouts in a central catalog. I mean, we do it through our configuration system, but this is extremely convenient because when you're debugging, you can quickly test, like, well, what is the timeout that they're using? And then you can go look at the property they're using to configure it. Not everybody uses this, but we do try to encourage it because it allows us to debug more rapidly and gain that mental model without reading their code, right? We can just look at the configuration. And so we look at this and we're like, whoa, 40 milliseconds, that's like less than one packet drop, man. Like, that's really low. And we also know something about the DataStax drivers, which is that they retry a lot by default on operation timeouts. So, like, this is a pretty interesting piece of your mental model that I think you should always have, which is that the default driver configuration out of the box is very aggressive about retries, especially on operation timeout, client timeouts. And so, like, for example, internally, I know that we've limited the number of tries that are allowed here. We actually often encourage people to turn them off. But it's an important realization that, like, okay, well, if we've got a 40-millisecond timeout and things get a little bit slower, and then this is going to result in the driver trying that query against every other host in the cluster, you're going to maybe have some problems. So from this, we immediately have an experiment. We can try turning off retries. We can set a configuration variable that turns off the retries. And the reasoning behind that is that, at least in my opinion, retries are almost always wrong in a distributed system. There's a couple of exceptions, like unavailable exceptions, where you like run into one Cassandra coordinator that doesn't have a full view of gossip, and so it comes back and says, I don't have quorum, and you're like, well, what if I asked a different coordinator, and then that coordinator's like, oh yeah, you're good, those replicas are totally up. Aside from that one use case, retries are almost always wrong. There are alternatives, like concurrency-limited speculation, and all three words there are important. Speculations by themselves kill your clusters. Concurrency limiters by themselves aren't sufficient. You have to put them together. And so we can increase the timeout to Cassandra to 100 milliseconds, which is what we actually promise, which is still very fast, and we can turn off retries. So we roll that out, and immediately the system recovers. So just from that experiment, can we say that we were pretty confident in our theory? Yeah, the data seems to show that. And again, we're like, you can see how we're always following this kind of scientific process that observe, react, test, observe. That's how we're going to do this. But debugging isn't just about figuring out the problem. It's also about fixing it so it can never happen ever again. So at the end of every kind of debugging session, I always like to ask, how can I automate this? How can I make it so that the system never breaks this way again? There's a pretty clear one, which is stop retrying, maybe turn off retries. At Netflix, for example, we've drastically reduced the amount of retries that the driver does by default. We've done a lot of education around the danger of retries, retry storms. Netflix has pioneered this with things like Hystrix and gRPC concurrency limiters. We're really very like gung-ho about not retrying. Just fail fast. Your upstreams need to be able to handle errors. If they actually have a latency SLO of 40 milliseconds, then retrying isn't really going to help them. It's very hard to retry and actually save that query. But then we always get into the, well, I still want to retry. And then I ask, well, could you do concurrency limited P95 speculation instead? And then they go, that sounds hard, so I'm not going to do that. And then I go, okay, fine, can you use exponential backoff? And they're like, that also sounds hard. And I'm like, okay, well, that's very sad. So because it's hard to get people to actually not kill Cassandra with retries and retry storms, we're actually working on the server side to provide automatic back pressure. So the 15013 ticket and the follow-up tickets to that are going to make it so that if clients are pounding a server, the server will actually start shedding load and pushing back pressure back to a client that is storming it. So I'm actually very excited about this because you know, maybe we can't get everybody to implement retries properly, but at least the server can protect itself and not explode. And I really do think that, I personally really wish that concurrency limited retries were more common. So I took a whack at trying to diagram out how this works. We can see here that a client would send two requests. And the reason why I'm so gung-ho in this is because like speculations are strictly dominant to retries. Like speculations, you don't throw away the other request. With a retry, it's like, oh, I had a timeout. Okay, I'll retry somewhere else. But if the first guy comes back, you don't take the response. With a speculation, at the very least, if you get the original work back, you can still use it. So that, I mean, to me, speculations are strictly strictly superior. But we do find that you have to protect yourself. So in this case, X and Y get sent at the same time. Replica 1 is garbage collecting, which is one of the largest sources of latency, of tail latency in Cassandra. And so then, after a fixed period of time, like maybe your 95th percentile, the client speculates the X query. And it wants to speculate the Y query, but that limiter there is clamping down and saying, you're not allowed to send too many. Like, speculations are precious, right? Like, if we think about it, if we let everything just speculate, we could instantly double our load and cause a speculation storm, which is what many implementations of speculative execution do. But if you put a concurrency limiter there, and honestly, I don't care what kind of concurrency limiter. It could be a token bucket concurrency limiter. It could be a counter where you just, like, add one and subtract one. Like, any concurrency limit that protects you from doing a storm of additional speculations until you get back some healthy responses is quite sufficient. So in this case, the concurrency limiter lifts when we get the response back from X from the second replica. I should say replica 2, not replica 1. And then the third query, Z, comes out, and it also encounters that GC latency. But now, because the limiter has lifted, we're allowed to speculate again. So you can kind of see with this diagram, I think, how kind of straightforward concurrency limited speculation can be. All right, so that was a pretty easy example. What if it wasn't that easy? What if when we went to go look at the replica latency graph, it looked something like that? So who's seen a graph that looks like this in their Cassandra cluster? Yeah, a couple people. One node is just doing something wonky off there, and you're like, what is going on with that node? And that brings me to the second phase, which is we're going to talk now about how replicas break. So Cassandra's replicas are running a stateful service on hardware, which is unreliable. And Cassandra replicas can degrade for many reasons. And to kind of start this section, I just want to go over very quickly. Oops, that's the Wi-Fi. I just want to go over very quickly what kind of tools I'm immediately running the moment that I get to a machine that looks like that one that we just saw. So I'm immediately looking at kind of like utilization, saturation, errors. I'm looking across the board, what's going on with the CPU, what's going on with the file system, what's going on with my drives, what's going on with my network, what's going on with my JVM. And I've highlighted in bold kind of what I consider like the first, like the very first tool that I'll ever run. And then the second ones are ones that I used as follow-ups. So for example, you've got HTOP. Who here likes HTOP? A couple of people. Yeah, it's a really useful tool because you can, at a single glance, you can get a lot of information about the utilization of a Cassandra machine. You can find out, am I spinning? How's my page cache doing? Because you can see the orange there. You can look at memory utilization, load average, which can tell you information about disks, CPUs. You can see thread information, which threads are runnable. Do I have all my threads in R state or... Or like, for example, if you see all of them in D state, that immediately tells you what's going on. Any theories? If we were to see all Ds in a row in the runnable in the status column, what would all Ds indicate? Bad disk. That's right, because that's the IO wait. Uninterruptible sleep state, which basically only happens when a thread is waiting on IO. But we can also like look really quickly, like, are we at a disk face? That sometimes can cause problems. So we run df and take a look. Okay, 18%, that's fine. We can also run iostat, which gives us a very quick view of throughput and latency and utilization of our drives. In particular, I find the latency metrics exceedingly useful. Like, there are so many times where drives will just be taking a ridiculous quantity of time to issue IOs or to service IOs that it can immediately explain latency spikes. But we don't stop there. What's going on in the network? You've got IFTOP, you've got NETSTAT. These things, again, can immediately rule out things like, well, who's talking to me? Or, like, for example, in this case, we see that 9042 is up there. That means that we're getting a lot of traffic from our clients, whereas if we saw our inner node storage port, we would think, okay, well, maybe we're getting a lot of data from our replicas. So just from this view, again, we're kind of getting that top-level view. We're building our mental model. So now that we kind of have those tools, let's go back to this problem. We've got the single node that's slow. So we look at some more graphs, and we start breaking things out. Disk utilization by drive is a good one, system load average, and low CPU utilization. So just from this data, again, we're refreshing our mental model. Again, what like from this data, I think it should be pretty clear a little bit of what's going on. Any theories out there? We've got low CPU utilization, high load average, and high disk utilization. Slow disk, all right. Yeah, either a failed drive or a slow drive. That's our initial theory. And our action plan is we're going to go use our tools to get a lay of the land and investigate any anomalies we find. All right, so we start off and we immediately say, okay, well, do we have a failed disk? We run some dmessage. We're like, oh, it looks like the file system's still mounted. We look at mdstat. The RAID array is fine. This looks fine. We run iostat, and we see this. That doesn't look fine. What doesn't look fine about this output? Latency, that's right. We're taking 8 seconds to get IOs back from this drive. That's kind of ridiculous for an NVMe flash drive. So we've ruled out our first theory of failed drive by looking at dmessage and other tools. And then slow drive at this point is highly likely. Iostat essentially confirmed it, but Iostat is an averaging tool. Maybe it had a spike, 30-second IOs, and then everything was fine. So to drive deeper, we're going to measure per disk IOs using BioSnoop, and we're going to double check that our theory here is correct. And then if we are correct, then we're going to remove the node from coordination and the replication, and we're going to detach it from the cluster. And the reason why we want to detach it from the cluster is, at least in the cloud, if we just terminated it, it might immediately come back. Like Amazon doesn't know that this drive is slow. Amazon has a very hard time detecting that drives are slow. So instead, we're going to detach it, and then we can actually report it as degraded hardware. But at the same time, we want to mitigate the impact to the user. So we're going to detach it from the cluster if that's the case. So we're on BioSnoop, and we see this. And I just include the full command here. I just have this in my pastebin, but it's really great if you can use BioSnoop to then, for each I.O., you can see how long each I.O. took, and then you can pipe it to a command line histogram tool, and you can get a latency distribution of the disk. So we see this really weird bimodal latency distribution. At this point, I'm pretty much convinced 100% this drive is funky. Like, there's no reason that we should have 20-second IOs out of this drive. This does not look fine. For context, this is what a normal NVMe flash drive looks like. We're talking 100 microsecond IOs. So when we see things like this, something's funky, and we know that. And something that I just want to call out here is a key part of debugging is having that mental model ahead of time of what your tools should be telling you. So I like to say, one of the reasons why I kind of go through this checklist whenever I go to a help to any server is because I want to know what it looks like when something's healthy. So that then I can detect the anomaly here, right? Like the moment I saw this, I was like, okay, the drive's bad. And the reason why is because I know what an i3 should look like. And that's, I think, a really key part to debugging is already having that mental model by having run your tools continuously throughout all time. And you have things to compare it to. But just for the sake of exercise, what would a failed drive look like? Well, in EC2, we generally see something like this. IO errors or the file system unmounts or goes read-only. These are really very easy to detect. Slow drives are a lot harder. All right, but going back to our original point about how it's not good enough to just define the problem, in this case, we're 100% convinced it's a bad drive. We're just going to terminate. It's going to fix everything. But we also want to detect bad hardware automatically and then preemptively take it out of the cluster. Because we could actually have detected, in that graph with the latency spike, we could have detected this extremely quickly. Like within about maybe 30 seconds, we could have detected that this drive was degraded, and we could have pulled it out of the system. So to do that, we've implemented internally, essentially internal health check system, which runs a system of essentially like pre-flight checks against the instance. So this is running all the time. It's ensuring that the instance is meeting our latency requirements. So some really easy ones are like, is the file system failed? That's pretty easy to check. You just run some dmessage, run some grep. Or if I'm seeing IO errors, because the kernel will report when it's unable to access sectors, how many of those am I seeing? Am I seeing enough of those? Or can I write to the mount to the directory that I need to write? Like if I can't write, if it's read only, it's a bad drive. And then finally, and I think really the only tricky classifier here is the disk latency in acceptable acceptably low for us. And obviously, any failure of this check would imply that we would kill the instance. So the only hard one here is disk latency, but Linux really helps us out here. There's this great facility called Proc Disk Stats, which actually gives you really good insights into how every drive is performing. For example, it tells you how many reads and writes were happening, how much time it took to service those IOs, how long it was basically active. So you can use the active time and the IO time to differentiate between the disk didn't do anything because it had nothing to do versus the disk didn't do anything because it's stalling forever. So just with those three numbers, active time, IO time, and your read and write per second, you can create a classifier that says this drive is performing within specifications. So we've done this, and it works great. We no longer have this problem where single replicas spike up due to a bad drive because our automation detects it and automatically terminates the instance or detaches the instance for us. All right, so in the theme of getting harder, now we're going to get even harder. Who's seen this statement in a Slack channel? We see high latency, high latency. And you're like, okay, well, what does high latency mean? Is high latency like a millisecond? Is it like 100 milliseconds? So we go back to our trusty dashboards, and sure enough, we see high latency. No real load trap, no real load difference, just some changes in latency. Well, that's interesting. Let's dive deep. Let's look into replicas. Ooh, this is odd. So it's not one node that's slow anymore. Now it's three. All right, so what's special about three in Cassandra? Any takers? Replication factor, that's right. So just from knowing that we've got three nodes that are slow, we can start diving deeper into, okay, well, why are those nodes slow? We head over to them, and unlike before, we don't see a spike in disk utilization. We do see a spike in CPU utilization and system load, so that's interesting. Those metrics are already starting to rule out some theories for us. But we can kind of take the theories that we've come and that we come up with, and we can list them out. So maybe we've got a hot partition. Maybe because a replica set is hot. Maybe we're running repair. Repair operates on replica sets. Repair could cause latency issues with a replica set. Maybe we've issued that replica set a query, which is causing us to enter some type of catastrophic garbage collection loop. Or maybe there's a Cassandra bug. I really hope it's not a Cassandra bug, but sometimes it is. And then we can form an action plan for each one of these. How are we going to test these theories? We can run some tools. We can inspect repair state. So let's start off with hot partitions. So who's familiar with the no-tool top partitions command? Good number of you. That's great. It's a super useful command for figuring out if you've got a hot partition. You can run top partitions, and Cassandra will tell you whether or not it's getting a lot of read or write operations for a given key. So you can use this to find out if that replica set is being requested a lot because of a particular partition key. In this case, this looks reasonable. We're pretty even. I mean, there's a little bit of imbalance in the writes, but it's really not a big deal. Typically, when you see an actual hot partition, like one of these partitions will have like 1,000 requests in a 1 second period. So that looks pretty reasonable. Now we look at repair. We look at our state of repair, and we look at this and we go, okay, well, those replicas aren't the same ones that are slow, so it's probably not repair. We can rule that out. And just by like a quick couple of tests, we've already ruled out half the theories. So now we're left with a juicy spiral of death or a Cassandra bug or something else. Let's hope it's not a Cassandra bug. So let's go look at the GC log. And Cassandra has really great GC logging because it actually shows all the details about every time the application ever stops. And to be honest, these are the only lines that I ever look at. Like I don't really care about like parnu and like how much parnu is collecting or not. The only thing I care about is how much time is my program running for and how much time is my program not running. And there are two key numbers here. So there's the first column there, which is the total time the application threads were stopped. That's for Java to either run garbage collection or to do any other activity that requires a save point. And then there's also this other number, which is how long it took to stop threads. So that's how long it took Cassandra threads to enter a save point. Now, these two numbers tell you a lot about what Cassandra's doing. If the stopping threads number is high, then that indicates disks. Can anybody say why a high save point latency would indicate slow disks? In the back.
Because your internal mode while you're trying to
collect
the disk, it has to wait for that to
occur. Inverse, but yes. Like you're waiting for a memory mapped read to come back, but yes, absolutely. So Cassandra uses memory mapped IO extremely heavily. the JVM doesn't know that that memory access is actually a disk access, and so it assumes that that is a very cheap operation. It doesn't check save points before and after. So you can actually block the whole JVM from entering a save point just by having a drive which is slow. This is like one of the reasons why best practice is to put the HSF perf data file, which is used by like various Java tooling, on a TempFS, so that that can't see disk latency. In general, just like don't have slow disks, I guess. I don't know. Use that earlier auto detection thing. We're definitely working on this. But in this case, the numbers are low, and the other number is really high. So when we see large numbers there, that indicates a JVM issue, some type of maybe we've misprovisioned the heap, maybe we've had a bad query, who knows. So now we have to dig a little deeper. And I always use this tool, GC Viewer. Who's familiar with GC Viewer? One or two people. It's a super useful tool for visualizing garbage collections because you can just give it any standard Java GC log, and it will spit out a pictorial representation of what your garbage collection is doing. So in this case, these black bars are 25-second garbage collections. And this node is going to keep doing that until the end of the universe. It will never stop garbage collecting for 20 seconds. And you can see that it kind of looks like garbage collects for 20 seconds, runs for 100 milliseconds, garbage collects for 20 seconds, runs for 100 milliseconds. I like to call this graph the query of death because something happened at that point, and all of a sudden, Cassandra is now in a death spiral. This is bad. So let's double check our proposal. So this is looking like Cassandra has entered some type of garbage collection spiral. We're going to observe the JVM state using Java tooling, JSTAT, to confirm or refute our garbage collection theory. And crucially, we're going to take a heap dump so that we can actually debug what happened here. Because we want to be able to debug why our database ran out of memory. So we run some JSTAT, and we see this. The two columns that I always look at are the E and the O, which is essentially the Eden space, or young gen, and the old generation. When these numbers are both showing 100, that's rounding, by the way. It's actually like 99.996 or something, if you actually like get the byte counts. But anytime this is showing 100 for more than like 3 seconds, you're having a bad day. And what's interesting about this is that you'd say, like, well, wouldn't the JVM And that would be a nice assumption. But the JVMs don't when they're at 99.99% all the time. So that's kind of weird. But it's a problem that we have in Elasticsearch, in Cassandra, in almost any Java database where it's possible for that database to load almost the entire data set into memory. We see this type of problematic behavior. So we think we've confirmed our theory at this point that it's garbage collection related. Let's run a heap dump to figure out why we ran out of memory. You can do that with this JMAP command. We actually do it using an agent, which I'll explain in a bit. But you can use JMAP to get it. If you don't have that agent, then you throw that up to S3, and you kill Cassandra. All right, so we've mitigated the problem, but we still haven't figured out what's wrong, right? Like, we know it ran out of heap, but we don't know what's going on. So we're going to take that heap dump, and we're going to open it up in your kit or Eclipse Mat, and we're going to look for what was running at the time. And what we start seeing is that there's a single local variable. This is Cassandra 2.1, by the way. I don't believe that this particular bug exists in Cassandra 3. But there's a single local variable which is holding 11.7 gigs of state, trying to return it back. And if you dig into the code, that's basically the result array list. Like, so it's like result equals do the query. And the result array list is taking up 11.7 gigs. You can actually dive into what query was it running. So it's like, okay, it was running a range slice command. And then you can actually dig in and you can see, well, what table was it? So I've blurred out the table names, but there was a range slice running on a column family in a key space. And I don't have the screenshot for it, but if you expand a little bit lower, it'll tell you whether or not the query had paging enabled. So in this case, this query was running a range slice on the largest table in the cluster with paging turned off. So can anybody say why would turning off paging on a select star query be a bad idea? Go for it. Exactly. There's a maximum amount that Cassandra has to hold in memory at any given time. And in this case, we were able to use, so for those of you who couldn't hear, he said that paging allows Cassandra to limit the amount of memory that it has to hold for a query at any given time. So you might immediately say, well, why in the world did someone turn off paging? And in my experience, there are usually two answers. Either somebody doesn't know what it does, and it makes their tests faster, because they turn off paging and their tests run faster, so they're like, all right, sweet, I'll turn off paging in production. Or in this case, the more likely thing is that somebody took a third-party off-the-shelf tool and connected it to their production database. And that third-party off-the-shelf tool doesn't know anything about Cassandra. So it thinks like, oh, select star is safe. And then somebody, for some reason, said select star, turn off paging. And now whenever anybody takes that tool, which I will not name, and connects it to a Cassandra cluster, we see these kinds of ooms. And so from that, and we were able to debug that because the heap dump also has information about where the query came from. So we actually backtracked it to this IP, and then we found the owner of that IP, and we were like, hey guys, like, why did you run a select star without paging? And they were like, wait, that's my laptop. It was running this tool. And we're like, please, don't run that tool. And if you're going to run that tool, don't point it at a production database. But because we were able to get that heap dump, we were able to debug the root cause and prevent it from ever happening again. Now, and that person in this case, like, they didn't know that tool did this, because how would you know, right? Like, no one expects, you know, the Cassandra analytics storage engine, analysis toolkit, I'm making up names here, to do horrible things to your database. And in small data sets, this is fine. Like, if your data set is smaller than your heap, this isn't a problem, because Cassandra can just hold it all in heap. But if your data set's a couple 100 gigs or more, then you're going to have a problem. All right, so how are we going to automate this? Well, we could ban people from running bad code, but that doesn't seem very likely. So instead, we'll just automatically detect when the JVM enters this state. We'll automatically get a heap dump, and then we'll automatically recover the problem, and then we can just send contextual emails like, hey, person who issued this query, just so you know, this caused serious memory pressure. So we do that using an agent called JVM Quake, which implements a leaky token bucket algorithm. So essentially what it does is a normal operation. It hooks into the C JVMTI API that Java exposes. And whenever the JVM pauses, it like adds debt to this bucket. And then whenever the JVM unpauses and runs code, it drains debt out. So you can think of it like if you garbage collected for 1 second, it would add 1 second of debt. And then if you ran for 1 second, it would subtract 1 second of debt. In production, we run it with a 5-to-1 weighting. So runtime is weighted 5 times more than garbage collection. We find that that means that we get almost zero. In fact, I have, in the past year that this has been running in production, we've had exactly zero false positives, because a 5-to-1 runtime weight essentially means that you have to have less than 86% throughput for your threshold. So in our case, the threshold is 30 seconds. So we have to accumulate 30 seconds of garbage collection debt before JVM Quake will take action. When we do accumulate enough of that debt, we classify the JVM as unhealthy, and JVM Quake can send a configurable signal to the process that it's attached to. So in our case, we send it a core dump signal. We send it signal 6 and say, hey, please take a core dump. Then we use the OS core dump facilities to stream that core dump up to S3 automatically. So our core dumps never touch disk. The JVM goes unstable. Core dump streams up to S3. We get a notification that there is a core dump for us to analyze. Like why? Like because we still want to prevent this from happening going forwards. And then the JVM, and then it sends a signal 9 to kill the process. Systemd automatically restarts it. Cassandra heals. Prior to the rollout of JVM Quake, we had between 1 and 2 GC spiral of death incidents per week. And since then, 0. We have not had this problem because JVM Quake deals with it for us, keeps us sleeping instead of waking up at 2 in the morning to deal with queries of death. It's been a huge help. And it's eliminated a whole slew of bugs that we don't have to debug urgently. So we still have to debug these problems, right? We still have to read those core dumps because otherwise, like, we could build up a lot of technical debt in the system. But we don't have to do it at 2 in the morning. We can do it the next day, which is really helpful. Which brings us to a lesson of debugging, which is if you can make it so you don't have to debug at 2 in the morning, that's a good way to be. You want to debug during the day, not during the morning. Just to give you a little more context with how the algorithm works, you can actually simulate, if you're curious, like I have a GC log where I think I had a garbage collection spiral of death. You can take that GC log and plug it into this Jupyter notebook, which is available on GitHub. And it can actually tell you when JVM Quake would have stepped in. So in this case, this is a garbage collection log gathered from a process after the fact. And it kind of visualizes how much debt is held. And you can see that there were like a bunch of these 1 second collections here. So 10 to the 0 is 1. But they were immediately paid down. So JVM Quake didn't step in here. And if it had stepped in here, I would say that would have been a false positive, right? Because a couple 1 second collections is not a problem. But it did step in once we had a couple of 20-second collections. So we had a 20-second collection followed by a mere 1 second of paying down debt. And then we had another 20-second collection. And that was the point. So 20 plus 20, that was the point where we exceeded that 30-second threshold, and JVM Quake stepped in to prevent the outage. Again, in the spirit of running your tools all the time, even when it's healthy, one of the things I love about GC Viewer is that it turns a very hard thing to get quick analysis out of, which is a garbage collection log, into a very pretty picture that you can immediately understand what's going on. So for example, in this case, this is a normal, healthy, concurrent merc sweep JVM. So we've got a small young gen, we've got like a bunch of stuff getting promoted over time, and then a CMS triggers, that's this yellow line here, this is the 70% occupancy threshold getting met. Then we can see that concurrent merc sweeping starts happening, the old gen gets collected, and everything's fine. And then here, on the x-axis, we're able to view the pauses. So we can see that there are no significant pauses, even when we run the CMS, we're only seeing a maximum of like 200 milliseconds of pause. So you can very quickly just look at this and say like, this is fine. I don't know about you, but I can't read GC logs. It's really hard. But I can look at this picture and say, this looks fine. This is G1 looks different, but is also fine. This is a really cool feature that G1 has with Cassandra, in any Java program, where G1 will automatically size the new gen down. So this is basically the old gen automatically getting resized for you. And then this is where you reach the like G1, it's not the initiating faction, I forget the exact configuration. But this is when you reach that, and then G1 says, okay, I'm gonna do a mixed mode collection, and we see that we never get any pauses longer than 100 milliseconds. So this is also a very normal G1 GC trace. I don't have one on hand of what a G1 trace looks like when it explodes, but it's similarly nasty. it can look nasty. It doesn't look like this. All right. So we've kind of gone through, I think, a number of like progressively more difficult case studies. This is just one I want to touch on real quick, which is the report of, was anything wrong at 12:52 a.m.? And I'm always like, well, that seems oddly specific. How do you know 12:52 a.m.? So for that, we look at our graphs, and sure enough, we see a little spike of latency in replicas at 12:52 a.m. That's kind of weird. We're like, okay, maybe something weird happened. We can start forming some initial theories. So we can say, okay, well, maybe FS trim ran, and my NVMe drive started pausing. So for those of you who don't know, if you're using Amazon i3 instances or M5Ds or anything with NVMe storage, you've got to use the Kyber I/O scheduler, because if you don't, you can end up with stalls where FS trim runs, which runs on a cron job. FS trim runs and will stall your drives for like 20 seconds. So we've definitely seen that before. That's always, whenever I see like a random blip, I'm always like, oh crap, was FS trim running or something? By the way, since we rolled out the Kyber I/O scheduler, no drive blips. Like because Kyber separates out reads from writes. And actually, I guess FS trim is technically fixed in the kernel in like 4.15. So a modern Linux kernel with Kyber, and that can rule out a large number of drive blip events. But it's definitely something that could still happen. Maybe it's some new maintenance activity that Ubuntu added that I didn't know about. So maybe it's a drive blip. Could also be a network blip, right? We live in the cloud. Things get dropped. It could also be garbage collection. Any Java program, it could always be garbage collection. Or it could be a Cassandra bug. And again, let's hope it's not a Cassandra bug, because that would be unfortunate. So we start looking at our metrics, we see disk utilization, network errors, CPU utilization, everything looks fine. Like this isn't problematic. We don't see any huge spikes. And just from those, we can rule out, well, it probably wasn't a drive blip, right? Because the disk utilization by drive is still low. So if it had been a drive blip, we would have seen a spike in utilization, a spike in latency. Latency is a better metric than utilization or throughput for detecting short-term drive issues. Disk latency or service time is your best metric for that. But again, it's fine. No network errors, no real CPU utilization. So we've ruled out two of our theories already. Now we're down to our trusty friend garbage collection. We're gonna pull out our trusty friend GC viewer, and we're gonna take a look at the GC log, and we see this. So this is an unhealthy CMS trace. The reason why it's unhealthy is we see this black bar here. So this black bar is a stop the world pause of 4.6 seconds. And it happened right at the time that the user reported errors. So we're pretty sure that, like, well, shoot, this is probably related. And if you dig into the GC log, you Google around the error messages, you find out, oh, this is a known bug in CMS. Like, CMS is not a compacting collector. So if it doesn't have enough free space in the old gen, or sorry, enough contiguous space in the old gen to promote to, it will stop the world for in our case, 4 seconds, and do a compacting stop the world compaction. So we go to our really excellent JVM tuning experts at Netflix, and we say, how can we avoid this? And they said, either stop producing garbage or switch to G1. That was their advice. They were like, either stop creating so much garbage, maybe make your new gen extremely high so that it can't promote as much stuff into the old gen, or switch to G1 GC. And we were like, well, G1, we heard that G1, you know, has some problems. And they were like, we run it in production across the fleet. Our metric systems use it. G1's exceedingly stable in modern versions of Java 8. And we were like, okay, we'll try it. So we roll it out. And sure enough, these 4 second stop the world compacting collections just stop. Now I will say that this is a somewhat interesting example because this trace is taken from a cluster which is one of our heaviest repair clusters. So it's doing a ton of sub-range repair. It's actually pretty rare to see this kind of issue outside of our clusters that do a ton of repair work. And that's because, like, at least in this version of Cassandra, repair is not particularly efficient. Although thanks to a number of contributors, it's gotten a lot better in trunk. So looking out for that. All right. So we switch to G1 GC. It works. We just use it. We roll this out. We use the G1 GC logs to confirm our experiment with, like, and we look earlier. We see everything's fine. It works great. All right. I'm going to close this talk on what I think is the most interesting problem that we've had at debugging in the past year, or one of the most interesting ones. What if it wasn't as easy as a system problem? What if it wasn't the JVM, it wasn't the disks, it wasn't the hardware, it wasn't the software, it wasn't a bad query? What if it wasn't that? What if it was more systematic? Let's go deeper. Advanced maneuvers. All right, so at one point we got this report. So a user came in and they were launching a new application. It was probably like the third or fourth largest QPS service at Netflix. And they were like, hey, we tried turning on Quorum because we heard consistency was good. And then our app exploded. And we're like, shoot, that's not good. That sounds bad. We have initially no theory. Like, why would turning on Quorum make an app explode? That doesn't make any sense. So our immediate action plan is just like, we have to find out what went wrong. Right? Like, what did we run out of? Did we run out of CPU? Did we run out of network? Like, what did we run out of? So we go and we look at our graphs, and we see some pretty serious CPU utilization spikes. No network errors, no drive issues. And we're like, that's weird. Like, why would turning on Quorum peg our CPUs? So our only theory at this point is, well, there must be something wrong with how Cassandra implements Quorum, right? Like, I mean, why else would turning on Quorum more than double our CPU usage? And so our action plan is, as always, we're going to gather information about the world. So we're going to profile, and then we're going to turn off Quorum. But we're going to profile using perf and CPU flame graphs, which is a great way to visualize CPU usage across the operating system and across the operating system and other functions. And you can actually search by Java function names. If you've never seen, who's familiar with flame graphs? Good. Okay. This number is getting higher. It's a really useful way of visualizing your CPU time. You can check out that tech blog if you're curious how to actually run them. You can also use the Java Async Profiler, which isn't quite the same data, but it's close. All right. So we start reading this flame graph. Read quorums do trigger. We know that read quorums require a digest, but, like, I mean, MD5 digest would be cheap, right? Like, come on, like, we can hash data quickly, more quickly than we can read it. But we start asking questions like, what's the cost of that hash? So we search for digest, and we find out that the cost of digest is 47%. So we're spending half of our own CPU time executing MD5 digests. We're like, well, that seems weird. So we dig in further, and we find that, like, of that 40%, 20% is calling this update with int function. And we're like, that's weird. Like, our data is, like, not ints. Like, why are we updating with ints? And so we go to the code, because at this point we're pretty confident that something funky is going on. So we go to the code. We use the function name there to go find out where it is. So we find this function. We're like, okay, that's interesting. So update with int is taking the digest, and it's taking an integer value, and then it's calling digest.update single byte updates in a loop. And you might immediately go like, well, that seems inefficient. But as far as I'm aware, this is the only way to do this without generating garbage. So I believe that's the reason that it works this way. We call update with int. Then we trace back to who's calling that. We look at the digest, and we see this. So we see a caller in cell digests, which are updating with int the column TTL. And so we're like, okay, well, that's interesting. We're spending 20% of our CPU time updating the digest with the TTL value. That seems odd, right? Like, we shouldn't spend that much time just updating with the TTL. And then we say, okay, well, where is this being called? Okay, it's being called for every column. So that's interesting. So we're spending a lot of time digesting TTLs of columns. Quorum costs 50% here, but why? Well, just from that data, from the fact that we're calling for every cell, so for every column, we're calling digest, which is then calling update with int of the TTL, which is then calling digest.update four times in a loop, which is taking 20% of our CPU, we can start forming some theory. So we can say, okay, well, what hash is it using? Because, like, some hash functions are slower than others. But also, what does the data model look like? Because maybe the data model could explain why we're spending so much time here. And we look and we search the code, and sure enough, we're using MD5, which is an interesting choice, because MD5 is significantly slower. So if you take MD5 of a file, it's going to be 10 times slower than XXHash, which, if you're just testing integrity, like, there's no reason to pay for a cryptographic hash. Like, it doesn't make sense. Yes, MD5 is slow, especially if you call it one byte at a time in a JVM. That's interesting, but that's not new, right? Like, that's not, like, a new thing in Cassandra. It's been using MD5 forever. But then we look at the data model, and we see this. And we're like, uh-oh. Who can identify the problem with this data model? Anybody? Everyone? Everyone? No one's saying it? All right, this could make super wide rows. Like, if someone's just inserting arbitrary ints into a set, this could make a partition which is excessively large. So we're like, okay, maybe something's wrong with our distribution, because wide partitions could be very expensive to digest. So we run table histograms, and we look at these counts, and this looks fine. This doesn't seem that bad, right? Like 40 columns on average. That doesn't seem like a big deal. But table histograms is somewhat of a lie. Table histogram shows you the on-disk distribution. It doesn't show you what data the user is actually accessing. So let's capture the live traffic using SQL trace, which is just a wrapper around TCP dump. And let's see the actual query distribution. It's on GitHub. If you ever want to use SQL Trace, it works with SQL version 4 out of the box. So we run SQL Trace. We can use that to capture the packets live off the SQL port, and then we can actually break it down by what partition keys are being accessed. And so in this case, you can see here, we've got these keys here. We're just pulling these out, and then we want to use those. We feed those into a script that we write to actually query the columns for those keys. And then we look at the distribution of how many columns are actually being read as opposed to stored on disk. And we see a very different distribution. This is not a median of 50. This is a median, or in this case, a mean of 5,000 and a median of 2,000. So that means that we thought that the data model was producing this blue line of partition widths. But in reality, because your hottest users are the ones that are actually interacting with this database the most, in reality, you're accessing very expensive users most often. So we look at that data and we say, well, is there a way we can make the rows smaller? We talk to the developer and we explain to them trade-offs of like, okay, well, this could have read, modify, write problems versus the other one, which can't have read, modify, write problems. And they go, yeah, this key is pretty unique, and we don't really expect the key to have concurrent updates because of the application reasons. So we're like, okay, well, if you don't expect this to have concurrent updates, then you can rely on that to deduplicate your events, and then you can just basically do read, modify, write on this text blob. Now, if we got rid of this key, if we just had the partition key and a blob, that would be really bad for a different reason, because we would be read, modifying, write a giant blob every time. But it turns out this kind of compromised data model, so it's not as consistent as the old one, but it doesn't have all those columns. So we can make that trade-off and we can fix the problem. But to automate this, we have to actually fix the bug. There are a number of open bugs related to this. The Cassandra community is working on it. But in this case, we were able to mitigate it just by changing the data model. And luckily, we were able to do that before they were in production running at 100%. But yeah. Okay, so the takeaway today is we've shown you in a series of events how you can kind of scientifically analyze, even like from the most simple to the most complex, to things that actually are bugs in the database. If you focus on building those mental models of the systems that you hold a pager for, then you can use the scientific method to debug almost any problem, even with Cassandra. Thank you. Any questions? One question. I can take one question. And then I can dig in the back. Yeah.
So when you take JVM down, actually, the JVM will be in the checkpoint, will be on pause.
Correct.
So it will take impact on your production traffic.
Correct.
So how do we avoid that?
So it's already. So the point where the question was when JVM Quake is stepping in, that you're basically doing that in a pause. So won't the application be impacted? At the point where JVM Quake is stepping in, you're already in a probably 60 or 70 second gray partition. Like the clients are already having problems talking to this node by the time that it's stepping in. So you know, we think that taking that extra, it takes us only about 45 seconds to get a core dump up to S3. So we think that taking, because you can stream it. So you can stream it live up to S3 through a compression algorithm. Like you don't have to put it to disk or anything. So it costs about 45 seconds. We think that's well worth the ability to debug the problem and make sure it never happens ever again. If you guys have any more questions, I'd be happy to take them at the back. Thank you very much.